Okay, House Judiciary is called to order. It's 2 o'clock in the afternoon. It is the 27th of March, and we have 2 items on the agenda today. We do have a full committee, almost, to conduct business. Representative Wilson is excused today. We have present for the record Representative Gruenberg, Cott, Coghill, Guerra, Anderson, and myself, McGuire. We're going to start with House Bill 439, Insurance Product Regulation Compact, and then go to House Bill 442, Healthcare Decisions. So, Representative Coghill, it's about 439.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for hearing the bill. Madam Chair, this is a compact that would allow states to get together for the purposes of life insurance, annuities, disability incomes, long-term care products, to kind of align some of the application procedures. I do not claim to be an expert on this, but I was at an NCOIL meeting where they did talk a little bit about this, and I think the issue is either we figure out a way to do it between states or the feds will figure out a way for us to do it. I think that's kind of the overall umbrella picture. This would allow us to enter into a compact. I think 20-some states already are doing it. I think you have to reach 26 before it becomes effective. And I would ask Mr. George if he could come up and help us out with that when it comes time for questions. It creates a place where you could do filing across states. You'd have a single point of filing that these states could go to. There's a couple ways that I would help the state of Alaska. In that we wouldn't have to go through all of those uniform standards, or the standards, I guess you could say, we would have to make sure that we're aware of and supportive of those standards. For the consumer, what it will do is, with annuities and life insurance policies, people hopping across state borders all the time get into a whole range of different areas of regulation. With automobiles, it's one thing because you're registered in a specific state. With annuities and life insurance policies, we're a much more transient population. These can be more portable across state lines. So I think that's probably the reason for doing it. This would actually give the compact some authority, though, and the authority would be for them to do the uniform standards that the state would actually have to go through. I would ask Mr. George to help me on that particular issue, because I don't understand everything I should know about that particular thing. But it would define what those products are, and then the state would follow suit with those products. Also, I have our insurance commissioner here. She's not really a commissioner, but she acts like one.
Right.
And she has a 2:30 appointment.
Okay.
So I'm trying to be brief, so I might have skipped over some huge details, but I really want to get her to the table. So, Madam Chair, if there's any questions to start, I think that'd be a good place to start with.
Hey, Linda, you want to come forward? Linda Hall, Vision of Insurance. Thank you, Representative Cocker.
Looks nice today. I answered most everything.
Okay. Linda Hall, Director of the Division of Insurance. I am a director. In most states, my position is a commissioner.
Commissioner, that's right.
Ah. Interesting.
What was that?
You're adjourned.
You're adjourned, Max. You're adjourned.
I'm sorry, we can't have her repeat that.
I attended the NCOIL meeting with Representative Coghill. On a number of insurance issues. I will speak very briefly regarding this interstate compact, and I do believe the figures. Today we have 21 states who have passed this interstate compact, and to a great extent the motivation is twofold. One is a speed to market initiative. I'm sure it will come as a surprise to you that insurance regulators around the country are accused of being very slow in getting products approved, and this is an attempt to move more rapidly in that direction. F- financial services marketplace is changing. We have a lot of interaction and combinations and mergers between banks, insurance companies, insurance agencies, and they're really looking for better ways to get products to the consumer. I believe Representative Coghill talked about the increased mobility of our population. This model compact was developed by the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. It has undergone vetting for probably 4 years. I've been in this position 3 years. It was before my time. It has been vetted with the attorneys general around the country as well as insurance regulators to be certain that it does meet the laws of the various states entering such compact. And I think probably the other largest reason for entering in this is to hopefully fend off attempts at federal regulation of insurance. I strongly feel that insurance should be regulated by the states. I think particularly a state the size of Alaska, we do, I hope, a very good job of consumer protection. Consumers call our office daily with various kinds of complaints. I don't think we would get that kind of consumer complaint reaction and intervention on a federal level. So I'm very much supportive of state regulation of insurance. The basic structure of this compact is to create a commission. Each state who is a compacting member would have a representative on the commission. Normally that would be the chief regulator, commissioner, director, whatever. In some states they're called superintendents. There are a variety of names around the country. Products would have to be vetted by this commission and approved by two-thirds of the members of the commission to be adopted. They will be setting standards. They're working on those standards today. States can opt out of those standards if there's a particular product that they don't think the standards are sufficient, because there was a real concern early on that this would be a race to the bottom. We want high product standards for our consumers, so we're not interested in a race to the state that has the lowest standards. That is not occurring as standards are developed today. States can opt out in two ways. By legislative action, you can opt out if there's a particular product standard that we think doesn't meet our needs. We would come to you and ask that today we have a different standard. We don't want to participate in this particular standard, say for a life insurance policy. The other way is the insurance regulator, by regulation, can opt out of a standard. If we determine that that's not something we want, we only have 10 days to do that as the regulatory agency. We would have to do it within 10 days of the adoption of a standard. We would have to file notice that we were not going to adopt that particular standard. Where a state, the commission becomes operational, as Representative Coghill said, if 26 states or 40% of the premium volume in the country join the compact. Products covered are both individual and group, life insurance, annuities, disability income, and long-term care. And as I said, the process for developing standards for particular products is through this commission. What will occur is filings will be made instead of to us if we would be a part of this compact. A filing could be made, still could be made to the Division of Insurance in Alaska, as it is today, or an insurance company can choose to make it through the commission. With 50 different state regulators and different rules, sometimes it takes a very long time to get a product adopted. So it's an attempt at streamlining but maintaining standards. So a company could elect to go through the commission, or they could elect to continue to come here. What we're seeing today in the standards that are being adopted, they really appear to be more protective than the standards Alaska has. I'm going to give you a couple examples. Currently, the standard that's being adopted for all of these products is a minimum 10-day free look or right to examine. Alaska law does not require such a free look period. Minimum readability standards. While we have language about products must be not be ambiguous or misleading, we don't have readability standards, and that is a standard being adopted by this group. No lapse guarantee, premium disclosures and standards. We don't require those today. So the things I'm seeing being adopted, or they won't ever be adopted till the commission is functional, but are being worked on, really are stronger consumer protections than we have today in our current statute. So generally, I think products that are filed in Alaska today are pretty much common across the country. It's more expensive for an insurance company to develop separate products for each state. So in these types of products, we will certainly accept higher standards than our statute requires. We won't insist that they scale back. But I think today that this is a mechanism for approval that is more streamlined. And as Representative Coghill indicated, NCOIL has adopted a motion to accept this, as has NCSL. So with that, if there are questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hall. Questions? Representative Guerra.
Surprise, surprise, surprise. Les has a question. thank you. And thanks, Linda. I appreciate the explanation. Here's the concern I have. I accept your analysis, and actually I think you've done a great job as division director, and I appreciate all your work. It's deserved. I meant that. And I like the fact that the compact has been operating in a way where they've been, rather than diluting state standards to protect consumers, at least adhering to a certain level, and if not increasing them. But what would stop this from in the future, when you're not division director, and we have a division director maybe who's less concerned about consumer issues, what would stop this from having us join a compact that would reduce the rights that people have in insurance contracts from what we have in current law? And I'll just give you an example. I used to represent people who bought disability policies. They'd become disabled, and the insurance companies would find amazing ways not to pay on the disability policy. So I have a concern. I want to feel real comfortable that I'm passing something that isn't going to have us join something that will have us adopt standards that are less protective of our citizens than they are right now.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I think there are two pieces to my answer to that. One, I think when you put together a group of state regulators, what you've indicated was a primary concern, and that the standards be such that they are high standards, and the states that have joined thus far have that same consumer protection mission, so to speak. So I think that it would be very difficult to pass weak standards given a body of regulators whose primary mission is consumer protection. The enforcement of the standards as they're written remains with each state division of insurance. There is a policy interpretation that would come through the commission, but the actual enforcement, and I think, you know, there have been some abuses in disability insurance that we can enforce today, we could enforce even if we were part of this contract. This is a filing mechanism to get approval for particular products, not the enforcement piece, actually. So if we have individual consumers who are harmed, we will still do that enforcement.
I'm still, again, looking at what happens if the commission goes awry or our future insurance director is willing to let the commission go awry. What would happen if we inserted in here that the division shall not agree to join in standards that provide a lesser level of protection and rights to policyholders than Alaska law provides for?
I don't see that would do anything negative.
That would solve my concern very. That would completely solve my concern.
I understand your concern. I mean, the legislature has the ability to opt out of a particular standard, but that assumes you know that standard is there, and someone would have to point that out to you. Now, I would be happy to point that out to you, but. It's a going forward kind of monitoring that would be required.
Can you sit here long enough that we can craft an amendment that makes sense while you're here? Well, thanks.
Representative Groomberg?
Although I've been in front of this committee before.
through the chair, Ms. Hall, for uniform law, and I can't think Since all the time I've been in the legislature, ever having had an interstate compact before us before, I got a book. There's a book on all the interstate compacts. And I went through it, and I was looking at a disaster relief one, but we didn't put it in military and veterans affairs. So I'm not as familiar with this as I am with uniform laws. With uniform laws, there is a uniform law, and then there's the official interpretation of each section and the statement of policy. Is there such a thing for this compact, so we know the official purpose, or did they just give it out there without any commentary at all?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, I have not seen official commentary at this point. The National Association of Insurance Commissioners has done a number of position papers, some analysis. I would be happy to provide those to you.
I don't want to make a career of it. I just thought that there was something.
There aren't any commentary at this point. It's not effective until you get to the states, and I think it's a, so to speak, a term of art, a work in progress. But it was my understanding through the chair that Representative Coghill, you indicated Alaska has joined some interstate compacts.
Oh, there are lots of interstate compacts.
No, Alaska has participated in.
Oh, yes, yes.
Oh, okay. I thought you said hadn't seen that. Okay.
Yeah, we have interstate compacts.
Sorry, my misunderstanding.
There's some involving juveniles and things like that. I just haven't had one come before me. As I understand it, so we've never had a discussion that I've seen. I don't know if anybody else in this committee on what an interstate compact is. And as I understand it, an interstate compact is a contract between states. The first state to adopt it makes an offer for other states to join in a compact. And other states accept the offer. And then it becomes a binding contract on those states. And it becomes effective when a certain number of states have done that. As such, it has a priority below federal law, which is the highest priority in the Supremacy Clause. And an interstate compact is below that in priority, but above state law. Like, you can't amend the contract, and you can't withdraw from the contract, I don't think, except under the rules of the contract. That's what I understand this to be. But as such, it is one of the more formal and difficult things to deal with from a state level. Do you know anything about that, where that has worked, Ms. Paul?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I am not an expert.
Guerra's the good-looking guy, I'm Gruenberg.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I really hadn't planned.
I'm always called Guerra. I don't think he's called Gruenberg, though.
Well, I'll call him that next.
Okay.
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, I am not an expert on interstate compacts, but it's my understanding this particular one, there are provisions that allow legislatures to even agree not to participate in a particular standard. There are methods of withdrawal from that interstate compact.
Is that contained in this?
Yes, it is.
It is. Okay. We can't amend this. We either accept it or reject it all along, right? Can we take it with certain reservations?
It's my understanding we can take, I mean, I know Representative Gruenberg, will that be better? Representative Guerra was drafting. I don't think it's, does it have to be adopted word for word? I mean, I know we've made drafting changes to it. I can't answer the question.
I don't believe we made changes to the compact
okay.
itself.
Madam Chair.
Representative Coghill.
The amendments that we have made so far to this bill are not to the text of the contract, but how we would respond to it or the severability issues and that sort of thing. And the amendment proposed by Representative Guerra probably could not go to the heart of it, but how we would respond, because I think we can make laws right now that we're going to enforce outside of this compact, but we would agree to work together with them under the conditions of this compact. But I still think we're not going to give up that much sovereignty. But once we agree to work together, we will engage with them, I think, in defining the products and creating standards and actually running our applications through that standard process. So I don't think that we give up enough sovereignty.
You're talking about administering the compact.
But I think what Representative Guerra was asking, and I agree with, is how do we know if we're off, our law is going a different direction in the compact, especially with regard to consumer protection. So,
Madam Chair,
Representative Bloomberg.
Has anybody on this committee ever dealt with an interstate compact before in the legislature?
Mm-hmm. Juvenile justice interstate compact came before this.
Did they brief the committee on what a compact is and how it works? I would like if we could get somebody to just briefly put on the record what a compact is and how it works, because all I know is what I read in the book, and it's a different animal than I've ever dealt with. And the rest of my questions, Madam Chair, a couple questions. You mentioned, Ms. Hall, that you can opt out by either legislation with no time limit or by regulation. And you said within 10 days. That's within 10 days of what?
The state agency, the state regulatory agency, has the ability to opt out of a standard. If, for example, one of the standards that's adopted for, I use one that's higher right now than our state law. If this commission created by the compact adopted a readability standard of third grade, and we didn't want our policies to be written at a third grade level, we as a division of insurance could opt out by giving notice within 10 days of the adoption. Once they adopted that, we have 10 days to give them notice. We will opt out. So the 10 days is after adoption of a particular standard that then the regulatory body, whether it's whatever state, but in our case, the division of insurance, could give notice to the commission that we're not going to accept that standard.
I see that. That's what Mr. George gave me that through the chair. It's page 13, approximately line 24. It says, within 10 days after the uniform standard is promulgated. When they say promulgated, how do they promulgate the standard?
They are meeting, they've been meeting for almost 2 years looking at products, member states that are interested in joining, and creating the various standards that we currently have in state law and in regs about what products must do, and taking the various standards in the states and determining what is appropriate for an overall national standard for these products. They will then go, once the commission is in force and actually operational, those standards will have to be adopted by that commission. Two-thirds of the directors on the commission, which is the chief regulators, will have to adopt the standard for them to become a standard. We're really talking about product filings.
Through the chair, the word promulgation is not the same as adoption. Promulgation usually means sending notification. And is that what it means in this case, the word promulgate? Does that mean that they will notify, and if so, do they do that by email? Do they do that by snail mail? How do they do that?
It's my understanding that there will be actual physical meetings of this commission, and I'm not sure that they have adopted operating rules that will allow or not allow teleconference votes. Those are usually spelled out in the operational bylaws of an organization. I have not seen those.
The reason I'm concerned is Representative Coghill and I have a bill in on this. It deals with credit card payment of bills. And if they send something out snail mail, it may not get here for quite a while. And and 10 days is not much time, particularly if a promulgation would be mailing something and then it would have to get to you. It might be over a holiday, and 10 business days doesn't apply, but you could have a disaster or something. You couldn't get to it. And then you have to notify them. Does opt-out mean that you have to notify them that you want to, that the opt-out has to be received by them within the 10 days, or do you have to mail it by then? I mean, I just want to be sure that you have enough time to do that, given the fact that we're so far away.
Given that we sit on the, through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, given that we sit on that commission, we would be aware ahead of time before a vote was cast. We would be voting yes, yay or nay on the standard. So we would be aware that that was occurring. So I think the fact that we're participants would give us that forewarning that this standard was coming up. We would vote, so we would know that there was a vote being taken, so we would be aware, we wouldn't be waiting for either electronic or snail mail notification.
Okay, and finally, Madam Chair, one more question, and I appreciate your latitude because I did have a number of questions. You said, Ms. Hall, two-thirds, I thought of the members, that was the term, must approve this. Was that what you used, two-thirds of the members?
And two-thirds of the members of the commission.
And how many members are there on the commission?
Depends on how many states join. There have to be 26 for it to be operational.
Oh, so two-thirds of the 26, then?
Correct.
Would have to approve the standard or what?
The standard, each
okay.
standard.
You said, so it was two-thirds of 26. That's somewhere around 16 and 17 states would have to do it.
But there could be more states than that. I mean, that's a minimum.
I understand. And then you said, or 40%.
Mrs. Chairman, if you had New York and California, you wouldn't have to have many other states because it's 40%.
That's what I'm getting next. You said 40% of the product?
Premium.
The premium. So let's say you have New York and California.
That's to get the commission operational.
Right. Well, that's to get the commission. That's not each standard. I see.
Cockhill and then Anderson?
I'll pass. She made my point already.
Thank you. Just for the committee's edification, as the chair of the Labor and Workforce Development Committee of NCSL, it's one of the 14 national committees under NCSL, and I chair that one, we dealt with this policy. We endorsed it. And there was clarification, and I can't remember. I've been the chair for 4 years, and I don't remember when we did this, but I know it was in my tenure. And if you look at the very page that Representative Gruenberg targeted, page 13, and you read line 20, the opt-out provision, it states that a state may opt out either by legislation or regulation duly promulgated, and that's where this 10-day effect comes in. But also, so in other words, you could have legislation that overrides this. You had made a comment. You said it goes supremacy clause, then the compact, then state. Well, state could override just in the heart of this. And then the other aspect, Representative Gruenberg, is that if you look at the 90-day promulgation period, it also states farther along there that a state has, the way I interpret it, you have the 90 days of promulgation, then you have any time through legislation, and then you also have the occurrence where a state notices that there's a problem, and or at any time the state becomes a compacting state and finds that the uniform standard does not provide reasonable protections for the citizens of the state, given the conditions of the state. I think there are so many ways. We're not locked into anything here. But conversely, it's instructive to look at NCSL, NCOIL, National Association of Insurance Commissioners, and the 26 states that have been innovative in agreeing to this. And I think on a broader level, I think it's critical legislation to have. And the commissioner, now you have me saying the commissioner, the division director mentioned the idea of streamlining standards and speed to market initiatives and things, and those are the things that we talked about in a state-by-state, bipartisan, big state, little state, you know, well-attended committee meeting at the NCSL level. So for what that's worth, you're probably going to be able to find, go through, you know, assiduously and ask some questions that maybe we can't answer directly, but on an overall spirit of the bill, I hope you support it, because I think it's a good step
no,
for
I'm not
Alaska.
Saying I won't through the chair. I'm just trying to find out, and I want to go back to 40% of the product. Does that mean that a standard could be enacted by just 3 or 4 states or 10 or 15 states?
40% of the premium.
Of the premiums, I'm sorry.
Is still premiums. To make this compact operational.
Oh, that's just to make it operational.
That's been stated a couple times on the record.
And I apologize for
Lockhill?
That.
And Madam Chair, the point of the points already been made, so no need
move
to
the bill.
Okay. Further questions for Linda, and then we only have one other person.
So.
Yes.
In 3:15, Labor and Commerce.
And
you're welcome
have,
to come.
John George is the only other person to testify. So, Mr. George, thank you, Linda.
Madam Chair, may I just ask the first
question? Absolutely. Representative Coghill.
Do you have a copy of the proposed amendment,
Mr. Jordan?
No.
Oh, here we go. I've got several copies.
I don't think it's necessary now that we talked about through the chair all the ways that we can correct, but
and that's
not that you asked me, but I don't think it'll harm the bill.
Right. I don't want us to surrender the right to take care of our consumers. And if there's a way that we have to use as a system that brings up flags a point. So if we have a director that is not responsive, I can understand that through consumer complaints or through insurance complaints. And my first question to Mr. George would then be, if an insurance agent or an insurance company saw a problem with a commission, how would we in the legislature find out about it? So I guess that's what I'm concerned about. And then if a consumer had a problem, how would we find out about it? Because that's going to be how we interact. And it'll make a difference on how we word this particular amendment.
Thank you. My name is John George. I'm here representing the American Council of Life Insurers. Essentially, all the life insurance companies in the United States are members of the ACLI. We have asked Representative Coghill to introduce this bill because we think it's an important, actually, consumer legislation, as well as making it much easier for life insurance companies to do business, to bring new products to the market. Imagine if you have to get approval in 50 different states, plus Puerto Rico, Washington, D.C., and all, and every state wants to be a little bit different, and you're trying to sell insurance on a national basis. As Representative Coghill mentioned, it's transportable. You buy an insurance policy when you're 20 years old. You may not collect on that life insurance policy until you die at age 90. In the meantime, you may have moved to four or five different states. And imagine if you bought a different policy, had you bought it in Alabama as opposed to Alaska, as opposed to Arizona, as opposed to California. It just makes sense to have life insurance be pretty much the same everywhere. And if you were an insurance company and you wanted to come up with a new product, would you go to Alaska first, or would you go to Florida, California, Illinois, New York, where the volume is? So we're probably really low on the food chain on getting new products here because they're concentrating where they're writing a lot of policies. This would allow them to respond nationally, get new products to the market, so it'd be good for consumers. I think it was very carefully worded in the compact, you know, sort of the escape clauses, so that a state can opt out of a specific portion if they don't agree with that. But I tell you that the life insurance industry is going to be policing this as well, because we don't want flaky products out there. We want a uniformly high standard. And given that all the different states, you know, get to vote on this, I can assure you that they will not be minimal standards, that they're going to be good standards. And that's what we want, because we want good products out there so we can maintain a good reputation among the public as well.
Okay. Further questions for Mr. George? Representative Gruenberg and then Guerra?
Just one question, Mr. George, I think. If, let's say, insurance commissioners from around the country get together and meet, and I'm going to be very gross here and say, and they're wined and dined and lobbied to death by a particular company that wants product X, then that will become potentially the standard unless the state opts out. Might that not make it somewhat more difficult for really consumers in the state to protect themselves if, in fact, product X was not good for consumers? I'm playing a devil's advocate here.
Representative Gruenberg, through the chair, it would probably be easier to wine and dine individual insurance regulators today and get your exceptions, those low standards, in each state individually than it would be to get it through the compact.
Representative
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. George, I'll represent you. I just spoke to Ms. Hall as she left and she ran to her next meeting. Her position, I'm comfortable on relaying it, is that she's fine with this amendment language as long as legislative legal makes it work within the context of the wording of the bill, but I'm fine with the language otherwise. Are you okay with it also?
Representative Guerra, through the chair. I don't have a problem with it as long as it doesn't somehow void the compact or whatever. I think we all want good material protection for the public, and if this provides some comfort level to you and doesn't somehow mess up the compact where we're, when we sign on, we're actually not going to be members because we voided it with this, then I have no problem with it.
Representative Coghill.
And I'll be interested in legal language, too, because on one hand, you're saying we're going to sign under compact, and then we're going to put an exception, a thou shalt not, on there. That could be an issue. I don't know. And I'm open to it because I don't want us to have a lesser standard, I agree, and I don't want our consumers having less protection. So if the thou shalt not agree to makes them have to come back to the legislature, that's probably good policy. But if it means that they, at the division level, then void the compact and we don't know about it for some time, then I don't know that I'm for it. So, I mean, I think we've already said that legislative work has to be in there, but they also have some regulatory authority. So I understand the need to move quickly or nimbly in these laws. I'm just concerned that we're going to sign under a compact and say, but if there are material or lesser rights, I suppose that's a big hurdle. And I agree with that. But I just wonder if, you know, if we're putting in I just wonder what the exception looks like. So I'm going to be watching language. I'm not going to object to the conceptual amendment, but I am going to be nervous about how it comes down in legal language. So I'm game to put it in and have that debate before it gets to the floor or hold it. I'll defer to you, Madam Chair, but that's a concept I'm in agreement with, and that is a conceptual agreement.
Representative Anderson?
You sold me the opposite way, and I'm going to object and vote no to the amendment and say that we deal with it on the floor. I want the bill to keep moving, but I don't want it to be expedited on the floor and have a vote and a long debate in opposition to Representative Guerra. I think that there could be a loophole in this to the degree where someone could continually challenge and effectively make ineffective this compact, and I can think of various groups or certain folks in the industry opposition that could cause a problem with this language. Good intent, but I would rather have it, and rather than hold the bill, I would rather have it assessed by legal services, have a memo, we can request that, and then before the floor, you can have a Coghill Guerra Coghill amendment and put that in to ensure.
I'm going to do that because I would rather hammer out, and I would be in agreement to work with the representative on that if he wants to, because that's my only nervousness.
Does it go to the floor until you get that?
Yeah, typically the ones we've dealt with as well, there's a standard pro forma kind of language that goes into the compact, and that I don't know, but generally they mirror each other, and so they all have to look the same, and everybody makes the same agreement. So I have a similar concern, which is that, one, it is a little vague. It's a little vague, the amendment. And so what is greater or lesser rights? And then the second part is that if it doesn't mirror it exactly, by definition, does that kick us out or not? And I just don't know the answer. So that'd be the only concern I have. Mr. George?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rather than modifying the compact itself with this language, what would happen if you put instructions essentially to the regulator and said you will opt out of a standard if it doesn't meet certain?
Madam Chair.
Representative Guerra.
I think that's what I meant with the amendment. I don't want to rewrite the compact. I want the commissioner to opt out if the rule requires that we reduce our protections of consumers. Mm-hmm. So that's exactly what I'm trying to do.
Okay.
Representative Coghill?
I think we'd have to go that route because we're not in a position to modify. We can say yay or nay on the compact,
exactly.
But we can tell ourselves if we have a problem with their standards, we could either put prohibitive or directive language in there.
And Madam Chair, what about, thank you, what about having a legal services memorandum on the appeals process? Because I think we're not clear, and Representative Gruenberg was concerned about that. And then we move the bill on, but with that. Or are you saying we finish amendment here now?
I'm just, having looked at the language, just have concern that we actually are saying we'll do one thing on one hand and not do it on the other hand, and I agree with the concept. So I'd rather see it written out in legal language so that it can be debated.
I'll do that, Madam Chair. I won't introduce the amendment. I'll work with Representative Coghill before it hits the floor. Does it go straight to the floor after this?
I think it goes to the Rules Committee. We can modify it in the Rules Committee if you want, or we can do it on the floor.
The circular, the infinite loop here is this, though. Let's say the compact comes up with a rule that really reduces the rights of a policyholder. We direct the commissioner to opt out because that's substantially reduced the rights of our policyholders. The commissioner doesn't. We're bound to the compact. Then what happens? So I guess maybe the answer has to be at that point we're bound no matter what we say. So I guess maybe it has to be we tell the commissioner you better opt out, and I guess if the commissioner violates that, then maybe we require them to send us the legislature a notification that they've adopted a rule like this. Yeah. So then we have to do we're notified that we have to do legislation the next year or something.
Yep.
Like that.
Yep.
That's exactly right.
Yep.
Yeah, there's no requirement that they notify us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's probably the way to think about it. Mm-hmm. Okay, right. So is there anyone else here in the audience to testify on House Bill 439? Anybody in on the teleconference? Okay, so public testimony is closed. It brings the bill back before us. We have one amendment. Representative Guerra will withdraw at this time or not introduce at this time and work with Representative Coghill. Representative Anderson.
Then before I make the motion, thank you, Madam Chair, for the floor. I'll state that we will contact legal services, and have them assess the process in terms of our liability and attachment to the compact as a state and the legislature, and kind of the appeal mechanism and scenarios that were offered in the committee. And with the amendment being withdrawn out of courtesy, that we will make sure any amendment necessary will be drawn up for Rules Committee before it even gets to the floor, to be efficient on the floor. That being said, I move House Bill 439 out of Judiciary with individual recommendations and attached fiscal. I don't think there's a fiscal note.
Yeah,
there's one that just came. Zero.
Zero fiscal note.
Very briefly, Madam Chair.
Representative Guerra?
I'm going to have the amendment ready for the floor. I'd rather not work on it at the Rules Committee level.
Okay.
So an amendment to that. Okay, so the motion is to move 439 with the attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations onto the floor. Is there any objection? Hearing none, 439 moves. Thank you very much.
I meant that in a good way.
I understand. Yeah.
Your point is, who knows what they do in the rules. That's
I don't
true.
Have great success in the Rules Committee.
He and the chair are very close friends. Okay, House Bill 442 is next up. Jacqueline.
Everybody Norman?
I forgot about that.
For the record, my name is Jacqueline Chapeau, and I'll preface my comments by saying I'm a little sick today, so I'm a little coughing, and the sheer volume of cold and flu medicine that I've taken to get here today might make me a little off my game, but I appreciate your time in letting me be here today. Passage of the Healthcare Decisions Act in 2004 was an important step forward in sort of modernizing and improving Alaska's healthcare laws. It was a topic of much debate throughout the legislature, and I think we passed some really good legislation. However, this bill before you, House Bill 442, it just makes minor changes to the Alaska Act. It provides a little bit clearer directions to those people that are actually implementing the healthcare decisions. And so the current law, it imposes a duty of investigation upon physicians who are carrying out these healthcare acts. What our bill does here is it actually conforms our language in the Alaska statute to the Uniform Act language, and it says that they have to act in good faith when time is often critical and they're dealing with patients. And we felt that was a more appropriate standard. It also substitutes the word physician for attending physician. We've talked with the doctors, and they felt that attending physician was sort of a passe word. They don't really use it as much anymore, and we wanted it to be clear that we wanted all physicians who were dealing with a patient to honor the advanced healthcare directives of that patient. Some other changes that it does, it clarifies when CPR can be used. It addresses the validity of orders from other jurisdictions, and it also indicates under what circumstances a DNR order is able to be revoked. And so, you know, the Alaska Healthcare Decisions Act has been immensely beneficial in helping terminally ill patients, their loved ones, their friends and family. And this legislation, we've tried to be excused upon very surgical and being very narrow about what we were doing. There was a couple very specific concerns, and we tried to address them very specifically. I know, Madam Chairman, it's a very broad topic that we could talk about for a long time, advanced healthcare directives. But I think if you look at the specific legislation before you, we've been very narrow in our efforts to clarify just a couple things so that those people that are implementing those healthcare decisions can feel comfortable doing so.
Thank you very much for your testimony, and I want to offer that to folks that are here in the audience or online or in the committee. I do not want to revisit the overall debate on the Healthcare Decisions Act, but rather focus on the bill before us today, which is very narrow in its focus. So to the please confine your testimony and committee discussion to those narrow areas. Questions for Ms. Tupou? Okay. Yes, Representative Guerra?
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 4, line 25. Can you please tell me, I can't figure it out, what the addition of the language, because the patient is a woman of childbearing age, does?
Through the chairman, chairwoman, I guess. I'm not really sure what the protocol is there.
That's okay.
1352.055 talks about if they have a reasonable belief that the woman could be pregnant, and that they're able, that sort of, I guess, the ability that they're pregnant can trump the ability so that the healthcare provider is able to do resuscitative measures on the woman because they think that she might be pregnant. And that was a policy decision that was made previously in the legislation, and here we're just addressing it so that this is the part of the legislation that talks about liability for the doctors. And so they just wanted it explicitly put in this section, but we're just referencing a section that we had previously decided that policy on. We're just expressly stating that the doctors are acting in good faith if they are doing resuscitative measures because the woman is of childbearing age and they believe that she's pregnant.
And Madam Chair, thanks. And Madam Chair, maybe you know the answer to this. I've always had difficulty with it. I'm trying to, and I'm supportive of the bill, and I'm not going to advocate a major change to it. But I always get confused as to the line where it's drawn between having a do not resuscitate order and withdrawing certain nutrition and other things that you're allowed to do under this law, and going the marginal next step, which people would call euthanasia. There are many people who are interested, and I hope we have a discussion at some point about that subject, about whether where a patient wants to be euthanized because they're terminal, whether that should be allowed. But can you give me a fair explanation of what the difference is between what you're allowed to do as a medical profession to help somebody die at their request now, as opposed to where the dividing line where you're not allowed to do it because it would be euthanasia?
Through the chair, not to revisit the issue too much, but to have a do not resuscitate order, you have to have a qualifying condition. So it's not just, I feel like dying, please help me to do this. You have a specific qualifying condition, and the definition for that is very clear, that you have something where you're unconscious and there's no chance that you'll ever wake up from that a coma. You have a terminal condition, and there's specific criteria for what the terminal condition is. And so so the difference with a DNR versus euthanasia, a do not resuscitate order is precipitated, and you can only have one if a physician says you have a qualifying condition. I don't know if that makes sense, but so that I guess what is sort of the impetus for it is different. Euthanasia is just, you know, but I guess would be different.
And I just to add to that, you know, for somebody who would decide not to be resuscitated, you'd have to have a situation where you go unconscious. It's an active state, and the decision is made rather than taking those resuscitation efforts to simply withdraw and allow nature to take its course. Different than euthanasia, which is you're going along, you're terminal, you don't know at what point nature will take its course, but you would like it to take it earlier, and a doctor intervenes at that stage. So that's the fundamental difference, as I understand.
And I was just going to say the latter case being during Representative Salmon's speech today.
Remind me, Jacqueline, though, I just am trying to remember. So if a woman is of childbearing age, remember the discussion, that's already a policy that was adopted. And I think then the duty is to ascertain whether they are pregnant. And then if they are, then I can't remember.
And through the chair, so then at that point you would administer resuscitative measures.
At any point in the pregnancy?
Through the chair, I believe that's the policy.
I think the State Affairs Committee spent more time on it than us. Okay, further questions? Okay, hearing none, thank you, Ms. Tupel. Okay, I have just three folks in the audience two that have signed up to testify, and none on the line. So the first person that I have is Shelley Owens, and then I have John Dawson, and that's it. So if you're here to testify and your name hasn't been called, please sign up. Welcome.
Hey, Madam Chair, member of the committee. My name's Shelley Owens. I'm the health program manager with the Section of Injury Prevention and Emergency Medical Services Division of Public Health. I'm a licensed and certified in the state of Alaska as an attorney, EMT, and firefighter, and I administer the Comfort One Do Not Resuscitate program for the state. We aren't commenting on the overall intent of the bill, but on how it affects EMTs and other emergency responders. On Friday, I provided a letter signed by Section Chief Tim Bundy expressing our concerns about Section 5 of the current draft of the bill. And I think you may also have an amendment dated March 24th prepared by Representative Wyrock, which addresses our concerns. The Comfort One program has been in effect for 10 years, and it provides a standard procedure for EMS responders outside of a hospital to identify and honor the wishes of a terminally ill patient not to be resuscitated when his or her heart stops. In order to obtain a DNR order, a patient, as Mr. Poe said, a patient must have a terminal condition or be in a state of permanent unconsciousness. The DNR order must be signed by a doctor and takes effect only at the time of cardiac arrest. If a DNR patient is choking on a piece of food, breaks a hip, or gets into a car accident, EMS personnel will treat them using standard medical procedures. We're concerned about the use of the term health care provider in Section 5, which is it's a very broad term, and want to thank Representative Wyrock for preparing the amendment, which would cure our concerns. The healthcare provider is defined in AS 1352-390, subsection 23, as an individual licensed, certified, or otherwise authorized or permitted by law to provide healthcare in the ordinary course of business or practice of a profession. This term would include emergency trauma technicians who have only 40 hours of initial training and advanced first aid. Section 5 would authorize providers with limited medical training to override a physician's DNR order on the basis of a diagnosis which they are not medically trained to make. It wouldn't be possible to train emergency providers, such as an ETT, to diagnose if a person is dying of their terminal condition or as a result of the action of the healthcare provider. I understand that a concern of the drafters is that if a DNR patient goes into cardiac arrest during surgery for a condition unrelated to the patient's terminal condition, a surgeon or anesthesiologist may want to resuscitate the patient. However, it's possible they didn't anticipate the consequence to the pre-hospital medical providers in the Alaska Comfort One program. There are over 4,000 emergency medical responders in Alaska, of which 75% are volunteers. They have only seconds to make immediate life and death decisions. They're the heart and backbone of our emergency response system in Alaska, but they aren't doctors and shouldn't be given the responsibility to revoke a doctor's DNR order. It wouldn't be fair to either them or the patient. We would urge you to accept the Representative Wyrock's amendment, and we will support the bill if this amendment is adopted. Thank you.
I'll make the motion.
Okay. Representative Anderson?
It'd be interesting to hear debate from the committee if they have a different perception, but I've actually talked to Representative Weirock a while back on this, and I'm happy to make the amendment. He had it drafted, and he's the sponsor.
Representative Anderson, do you mind if we have just the other person to testify, and then we can take it up just to see if they have a thought on it? Thank you. Questions from Ms. Owens?
Thank you very much. I have a question for the chair.
Okay. Representative Groom?
I sort of assumed, and I probably shouldn't, that you would have all received correspondence from Ken Kirk. Did anybody else receive anything from Ken? Ken Kirk's a very fine family attorney, and he also practices in this area. Did you receive? Oh, okay. He wrote an article for the Alaska Law Review on the act itself, noting a number of deficiencies in this. And I would have thought, and I shouldn't have just let it go, that he would be one of the witnesses. He has a number of very specific suggestions, and I do apologize. This got lost in the shuffle. I have a copy of his article, which he sent to me, and I would like the committee to have the benefit of his thinking, and the sponsor, too. For example, he says that there's a misreference to conservatorship, where they mean guardianship and some things like that. And I would like to get a copy of this to everybody on the committee and the sponsor. He's really an expert in this.
Man, I'm sure that's in the Alaska Law Review, actually. Yeah. So it's a little bit, it's not just a letter from him. I mean, it's something that was published at Duke University through the law.
Yes. Yeah, I do apologize. I sort of interrupted, but I thought everybody would have, I apologize.
Okay, we'll do that for sure. Questions from Ms. Owens? No more? Okay. John Dawson?
We'll coordinate with you on that. I apologize for that. Sorry.
Mr. Dawson?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Dawson. I'm a partner with the law firm of Davis Wright Tremaine. I represent the folks at Providence Anchorage Anesthesia Medical Group, which is a group of anesthesiologists that provide anesthesia services to Providence Hospital. But the issues that are addressed by this amendment are clearly of interest to all of the doctors in the state. I wanted to sort of emphasize for the committee the importance from a real-world perspective of passing this amendment. It's because the doctors, as they've attempted to comply with the statute, have found themselves in sort of a catch-22. They want to honor the wishes of the patient, and at the same time, they want to comply with the law and avoid liability. The statute, as it currently exists, speaks of a requirement that the doctors act reasonably. And if you look through the statute, it's clear that it would impose on them, whenever they're trying to comply with a DNR or an advanced health care directive, it's clear that it would impose on them some measure of investigation, both factually and legally, as to whether the order in front of them or the advanced care directive in front of them is factually and legally supportable. And we have seen that in the trenches, this problem becomes particularly an issue when you have orders coming from out of state. We found that doctors were being called upon to decide whether a particular order complied with the state of New York. And as currently enacted, they had to be not only physicians, but they had to be lawyers. Or they had to have their lawyer, you know, available 24 hours a day to answer a question when suddenly they have a patient coding. As a practical matter, it couldn't happen. And what we were seeing then were doctors faced with the decision either to violate the statute and to perform CPR against the wishes of a patient, or to expose themselves to potential liability because they honored the order but don't have the foresight to go out and learn all 50 states' laws concerning DNR orders and advanced health care directives. That's one of the primary issues that was addressed by the statute, and I think the amendment does an excellent job of making it clear that what's required is good faith, not a law degree. The other issue that is addressed by the amendment is a situation where you have patients who have DNR orders who are having other sorts of work done. Just because somebody is in an end-of-life situation because of a terminal illness does not necessarily mean they're dying tomorrow. There are many situations in which you have somebody who may have a number of months left, and yet they may be seeing a physician for some sort of a procedure in order to make those remaining months comfortable. Classic example is if you have an elderly patient who is suffering from a terminal illness but who falls and breaks a hip, that person may go in for surgery. Just because they have a terminal illness that might end their life in 6 months does not mean that you don't take care of them in the interim. The way the statute is currently drafted, if they were to go into surgery, and let's use the example of an anesthesiologist, if that anesthesiologist were to administer too much anesthesia, as currently written, that anesthesiologist would not be able to correct his mistake. Strictly speaking, there's a DNR order in place, and this patient who went into surgery with the intent of improving themselves is in a situation being essentially allowed to die because the anesthesiologist can't correct his error. I'll give you another example. Let's say somebody who with months to live gets stung by a bee, and they happen to be allergic to bee stings, and they are suffering from anaphylactic shock, and their heart stops. The current legislation would prevent a doctor from administering something to prevent that patient from, or from bringing them out of anaphylactic shock. Presumably, people who seek medical assistance, even when they have a DNR order, want that medical assistance to succeed. And if there is a mistake or if there's something else unrelated to that condition that needs to be corrected, then it ought to be corrected. This amendment permits that to happen. It also provides some additional protection for a physician who decides to rely on the DNR order to know that in the event that he allows the patient to pass on, he's not going to be sued by somebody who decides that, in fact, he committed malpractice. As existing legislation basically puts a physician, even though he honors the DNR order, there's nothing in the existing legislation that would prevent him from being sued for malpractice for allowing a patient to die, even though there's a DNR order. This corrects this by saying, look, if a physician is negligent, allegedly negligent, and a patient dies because that physician is prevented from performing some sort of CPR, in that circumstance, he won't be sued for malpractice merely because he honors the DNR order. We're trying to avoid, what this amendment is trying to avoid is the situation of a doctor being sued for malpractice because he didn't do CPR in the face of a DNR order that prevents him from doing CPR. Hmm. And that actually is about all the comments I had, unless the committee has questions. I was one of the individuals that assisted in the preparation of the amendment and have consulted at some length with the various folks that have been working on it.
I was shaking my head at the situation, not you.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask, your name again?
John Dawson.
Mr. Dawson, did you read Ken Kirk's article?
I read parts of it. I read the parts that concerned my clients. I didn't read all of his case examples at the end of his article. I think he provides some interesting examples of how nationally recognized cases would have been treated under your statute.
Okay. I'm getting that duplicated. I was shaking my head.
This may not be for him. It may be for the sponsor of the bill. But we have here the definition: healthcare provider does not include a physician, and I'm just curious as to why, because it seemed to me that you could have a physician put in the same position as a healthcare provider, and maybe there's a good answer to that. I just don't see it.
Through the chair, actually, I think I can respond to that. The amendment, as I understand it, is designed in some respect to.
Do you need this?
Yes. It's designed to prevent emergency medical services personnel from being in the situation of having to exercise discretion. But the idea here is that if you're a physician in the field, the physician ought to have that discretion. So the amendment is basically saying an emergency technician is not going to have that discretion unless he or she is directed by a physician. Whereas if the person providing those services is himself or herself a physician, then we don't have that concern. They should have the discretion afforded to them.
Got it. Does that answer?
Okay. I have one
question, Representative Crew.
Yeah, just preliminarily one question. You're concerned, and rightly so, that docs aren't getting sued for just being caught in the middle of controversies. This has an immediate effective date. Do we need to have a retroactive effective date to the date of effect of the original bill?
Clearly, I would think that's appropriate. I know my clients would be pleased simply to get it enacted, but I think it would be appropriate to have it retroactive. I cannot imagine that at the time the original act was passed, that these consequences were foreseen, and so it's appropriate to have it retroactive to cure that.
Madam Chair, as we take this up again, I'm going to have this drafted, a retroactivity, but the reason I'm not offering it right now without having it drafted, because it may be that based on when people read Mr. Kirk's article and think about this, they may not want every clause in the bill to be retroactive. And Mr. Dawson, I'd like you to carefully look at the bill, and I hope you're here and you're online when we consider this again, to see if there's anything in the bill that you don't want to have retroactive. And as a matter of fact, even let me know before I get that drafted.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Representative Guerra?
I would just say this. I mean, I think I don't have a problem making this thing retroactive that we never intended to happen in the first place. So that's fine. I do warn you, Representative Grunberg, that the moment you do a retroactivity provision on the floor, there are going to be people who...
No. It's going to be in this committee. I'm not doing anything on the floor in this.
Okay, Ms. Dupont, I wanted to have you come up and ask you whether or not
John,
the bill's sponsor, who's a lawyer, is aware of the Alaska Law Review article, and if so, what his thoughts are, and if you considered including those changes, and if not, why not?
Through the chair, to answer, I guess, Representative Grunsberg's concerns, we are familiar with the article in our office, and my boss is very thoroughly familiar with it. I think that there are some things in there that he agrees with, and some things he doesn't quite agree with the legal analysis of. As far as what we want to do this session with 39 days left, I think, we were very systematic in deciding what we wanted to do. We introduced this one of the last days of personal legislation and just wanted to make sure we got the liability for the docs in there. So this is not a bill that we want to go back and revisit the Health Care Decisions Act and revise things. That wasn't what we decided to do this session, because I think then effectually then you're just saying we're going to do nothing this session, and then the doctors are still going to have problems with liability. So we decided what we wanted to get done in this last little bit of session, but have thought about some of the things in the article in the Law Review, and we'll think about those, and I think that's something for maybe a two-year legislative session, because I don't know if you guys remember from last time I worked on this bill also, very time-consuming to open this Pandora's box.
Representative Hudson worked on it before Representative Wyrock. I mean, it's been around since 2000.
Yeah, so through the chair, we wouldn't be friendly to any amendments to change the legislation at this point because of what we are trying to accomplish with the narrow window of time we have left this session.
That's why, Representative Grunberg, I wanted to get that on the record. That was my understanding. I'd be happy to have it distributed, and I think it's food for thought for people to chew on, but I respect the bill's sponsor in his decision about what he chose to include or did not. So, Representative Grunberg?
Oh, that being said, and I just glanced at the article, which is being duplicated now, but it looks to me like there's some technical things referring to the misreferring to a conservatorship when you should be talking about a guardianship. I want to be sure that Representative Wyrock doesn't want to cure that kind of stuff up in this bill. And I'd like to at least have a day to talk to him about it.
And through the chair, he's immensely familiar. Obviously, he's a member of the bar, and he's read it numerous times and is very familiar.
Is he here today?
He is. Madam Chair, he's up in finance right now.
They're doing the tax on the PBT.
Yeah.
Their first discussion on it.
Let me take a brief at ease. I just wondered if he had an order 315, and when we left off, we took an at ease to ask Representative Wyrock to come down, and we just decided we won't. So we're back with 442. Is there anybody else in the audience that wishes to testify? Anybody else online? Okay, hearing none. Public testimony is closed on House Bill 442. It brings the bill back before us, and we do have a written amendment. Says Wyrock. You can just put my name on it. So, McGuire, Amendment 1. This is the bill sponsor testified to this amendment. So, I'll move Amendment Number 1. Is there an objection to Amendment Number 1? OK, Okay, hearing none. Amendment number one carries. Amendment number two, Representative Gruenberg.
I'd move that we change the effective date clause. It might be that we have a separate retroactivity clause, I guess, whatever they do. I think that we have to have a separate retroactivity clause. Yeah, that we add a retroactivity clause that is effective as of the date of the enactment of the underlying bill, the other bill, whatever the bill is.
Okay. Everybody understand
the Health Care Decisions Act of 2004. I'm sorry?
Yeah.
You want to do that for the entire bill?
Yeah, the whole thing.
Okay. Is there an objection to amendment number two conceptually to change the effective date? Okay. Hearing none. Amendment number two carries. Are there further amendments to House Bill 442? Okay. Hearing none. Motion, Representative Cox?
Mr. Chair, I'd move committee CS for House Bill 442 as amended with individual recommendations and zero fiscal note.
Okay, is there an objection to that motion? Hearing none, House Bill 442 as amended has moved. Okay, and with that, we're adjourned.